It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. One of my favorite prayers is by Unitarian minister A. Powell Davies, who served the All Souls Unitarian Church in Washington, D.C. until his untimely death from cancer almost 50 years ago. May the life of our minds and breath of our being bring us once more to full remembrance of our greater calling. Strangely do we walk through the days of our years, unseeing, unhearing, inattentive, and the glory of life is all about us, and we do not know that it is there. We wrap ourselves up in the petty and the trivial, and sometimes even in the mean and sordid, shutting out life's promise. We are afraid of life, afraid of its truth and goodness, and its mighty claim upon us. And we wall ourselves in, thinking to be safe, and so we scarcely live at all. Oh, may the walls be broken down. Let winds that have swept the far horizons blow now upon the barriers that we have built to keep us small. Let them all be swept away, that the light of the heavens may light our lives, the vision of good enlarge our minds, and the love of all that is noble and true find room in our hearts. How vain are all our hopes, how empty all our prayers, until we ourselves are ready to fulfill them. Amen. There's something about that hymn that may have sounded or felt funny to you, and that's that even though it isn't marked that way, it's a hymn in 7-4 time, and we're not used to singing in that time, and it feels like we're missing a beat. I think the subject of the sermon today is one of those too. We're not used to thinking about the idea of reconsidering the idea of God. Gods get talked about almost in cartoon terms in our culture as though they're critters. When people ask questions about God, it's usually a simple true-false question. Do you believe in God? Yes or no? And the only way that question makes sense is if there's this critter somewhere. Yes or no? But that's not really what gods are. Gods are concepts, not critters. Ideas, not beings. And that's what we want to talk about today. One of my favorite stories in any religious scripture comes from the Old Testament. It's the story of Jacob wrestling his God by the river Jabbok. Biblical scholars will say this wasn't really quite God he was wrestling with. It was sort of a local deity. It's part of how we know it was such an ancient story. Ancients used to believe that all boundaries were guarded by gods that you had to fight in order to cross the boundary. That's what ancient primitive peoples believed. It's also what modern psychologists believe. Boundaries are all guarded by gods that we have to fight if we're going to cross them. That includes boundaries that have kept us too small or too ignorant or too enslaved, that are also guarded by gods that have to be wrestled with to cross them. That's what we're talking about this morning. It's a risky thing to do, this idea of wrestling, even with the idea of gods. In the Jacob story, he held on all night, finally getting the gods' blessing before the sun came up. It was a very ancient story. It was a story about gods that, like vampires, couldn't survive in the daylight. And Jacob was going to hold on until sunrise, which would destroy the god, and so the god gave him his blessing before the sun came up. It's an extremely ancient story. It's a really wonderful story. But even though he got the God's blessing and he got a new name out of the fight, he also came out with a limp. And he carried that limp for the rest of his life. And I think that there are limps involved in wrestling with God's too. So it's risky. But we're brave. Besides, we're just pretending. Maybe. What I want to persuade you of, this is a very hard thing to do. I've already forgiven myself for failing. What I want to persuade you of is something that you need to know about God's by convincing you that it's something you already know and have known for a long time. And that is that all gods are more like puppets than they are like puppeteers. They speak the words given to them by those who control them, even if they roar. There are good and bad concepts of God. And to wrestle with God is really to try to find out who are the puppeteers making this one say those things and deciding whether those are the sorts of things our God would want to say. Here's what you already know. We already and automatically wrestle with almost every authority that claims power over us. I'll give you just three examples before we talk about religion. These are three things you already know. Automakers routinely tell us that their machines are safe, but both governmental and private agencies like Consumers Union never believe them and routinely run tests to find out whether they're telling us the truth, and routinely expose design flaws that the manufacturers were covering up. Why did the manufacturers cover them up? Because they had millions of dollars at stake. And why did we investigate them? Because we know that. Now, this is very simple stuff, but there are three steps involved in all this, and I want the three steps to start emerging and taking root in you. Let's go to a second one. Think about food. Our great meatpacking plants are always telling us that the meat is safe, and therefore, that it's safe to eat it. The FDA never believes them. Oh, ye of little faith. And they're routinely inspecting giant meatpacking plants, and so they sometimes uncover the fact that 100 tons of hamburger contain E. coli, aren't safe to eat, and could even be deadly. The fact that an authoritative voice wearing a suit or a white lab coat tells us the meat is safe doesn't fool us. We know they've got something at stake in convincing us we should buy that hamburger. And so we check it out. Lives are at stake. We have to. Let's take a third and see if these three steps start becoming more clear. Let's take pharmaceuticals. I remember when the manufacturers of Fen-Phen, to pick only one, were on trial and how they insisted that the drugs were just effective weight-reducing aids with no serious side effects, that they'd been extensively tested on animal tests and human tests, and everything was fine, and it was safe to buy them and to keep their stocks from falling. But the FDA wouldn't take their word for it. They did independent tests and found that Fen-Phen damaged heart valves and could be fatal. We had a member of this church, a woman in this church, who died a year ago last month from damage to her heart valve caused by Fen-Phen. We know that authoritative people sometimes lie. Even if they really believe what they're saying, we know they could be wrong. So we check it out because lives are at stake. Now, here's the three-step process. by which truths and beliefs and gods are created. I won't go through the steps in order because that's the secret to these steps. The first step has to be invisible or the game won't work. So the second step is that some authoritative looking person tells us this is true. The third step is that since it's true, we need to follow it and obey it, and it's safe to do so, and everything will be all right. But what all of our investigations show is that there is often a first step that was kept invisible. And the first step is that there's some set of facts or picture of the world that empowers or enriches the people trying to sell it to us. They have a stake in it. It's how they see things, and they don't even know how to doubt it. They may really believe it. So the whole three-step process goes like this. Very simple. First, I want you to believe something. For a variety of reasons. Because if you do, it will empower or enrich me, or it will confirm my view of the world. Or it's because I really believe it and I have no idea how else to think about these things, so I'm sure it's true. But it starts with me and I've projected something out. Second step is, I convince myself and then tell you that this is true. And from there it's easy. The third step is, since it's true, you need to buy it. But if we want to know whether it's really good or true or safe, we check it out. Now, if this is reminding some of you of the story of the Garden of Eden, it's because it's supposed to. What we learned in the Garden of Eden story were that the people who wrote it 2,500 years and more ago, and the people who had adapted it from even earlier myths, the invisible first step was they wanted people to remain obedient to the authorities. That was the first step. The second step was they said, don't eat from that tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That would really be bad for you. And I'm telling you the truth. So since it's the truth, you need to obey it. And what Eve did and what the snake did was say, you know, it's this invisible first step that's wrong here. And the way that myth was celebrated for many centuries was as a celebration of human free will. Celebration of the fact that we can learn the difference between good and evil, and that that's the fact that puts us outside of a fool's paradise. You don't ask true believers to investigate their own truth claims. You don't ask Ford executive whether the gas tanks on their Pintos are safe. You don't ask the manufacturer of SUVs whether those vehicles have a high likelihood of tipping over and killing their passengers. You don't ask the manager of a Jack in the Box restaurant whether it's safe to eat his hamburgers. You ask a non-believer. You ask an outsider. Bring in a serpent if you want to find out what's really true. And you ask somebody who's left the Garden of Eden, who can tell the difference between true and false, good and bad, good and evil, fact and fiction, and you let them investigate. Now that's how we find out what we feel most safe believing. This process looks a lot like the scientific method. There, somebody proposes a theory and says it's true. A whole bunch of other scientists say, I don't think so. And they set up experiments as non-believers to find out whether it's true for people who don't believe it. And if it's true for them too, then so far it'll pass for true until somebody else comes along and finally debunks it. And we do these tests every day in all these areas, in science, in automobile manufacture, in pharmaceuticals and food, and in religion, because there are lives at stake. And it matters whether it's true. And until we find out for ourselves, we can't be sure. We seem hardwired to respond to authoritative people and voices, especially if they're in costumes. White lab coats, black robes, suits with flags on them. Advertising agencies, politicians, and slick preachers all count on this. So the buyer should beware. Now, I'll tell you one more story that brings all these three points in, and you'll be able to spot them all. And I like the story partly because it makes the invisible first step so dramatic, and it's so much more honest about it than we usually find it. It's a true story, one that Joseph Campbell told about tribes in South America that used the churinga, or the bull roarer, to terrify people. This is an amazing thing if you've never heard one of these. It's a stick, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet long, with a couple slots in it at one end and a hole in the other that you put a rope in, and you spin this thing around your head, and the slots make noise. And if you do this, it's a sound unlike anything you've ever heard. It's just kind of a wong, 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 wong. It's an amazing sound. Now, you identify the steps as we go through this. The way the tribe is kept in line is that the gods speak at night when they're unhappy. And the way the gods speak is that they make that noise. And if you're asleep at night and you're suddenly awakened by this, you know the gods aren't happy. Now, luckily for you, the next day, the men of the tribe, who just coincidentally happen to speak for the gods, will tell you why the gods aren't happy and what you need to do to make them happy. And then everything is fine again and life goes on. The dramatic point comes when young men are initiated into adulthood in the tribe. It's very dramatic. They stage this where the women of the tribe pretend to protect the young men as men of the tribe, wearing masks and costumes, come to kidnap them. And the women put up a mock fight, but the men overpower them, and the young boys, 13, 14 years old, are kidnapped and taken out into the woods, and they may well be terrified. Because they know the second and third step. They know that when the gods are unhappy, they make noises, and that they better obey what the gods want when the men of the tribe make it clear to them the next day. They know those noises are terrifying things. But this is a secret that is protected on penalty of death in this tribe. And one of the stories Joseph Campbell related was a time when the tribal chieftain's own daughter discovered his bull roarer tucked under his bedding and brought it out and asked what it was. She was killed for this. You don't mess with this. This first step is invisible and deadly. Now, what happens after the initiation, and I don't think I want to go into a lot of details on it. It's Sunday morning. It's a very bloody initiation. The word for what they do to the young man is subincision. It's bloody. And afterward, when these young men are lying tied to the tables, terrified and bleeding and hurting, one of the other men takes the bull roarer and they dip it in the young man's own blood and they bring it up by the young man's face. Then they remove their mask so the young man recognizes this man as someone he's known all of his life. And the man in the tribe leans over to the young man's ear and he says these words, "We make the noises." That's the first step. We make the noises. This is what all the investigations of defective cars, unhealthy foods, and bad drugs reveal too. Someone behind a white lab coat or a suit is making the noises. And we've learned not to believe them until we've checked it out for ourselves, because lives are at stake. And that's how gods are created too. I don't mean critters. I mean concepts of God. There are thousands of examples from religion besides that bloody, dramatic one that's so great. To keep this very simple, let me take just three pictures of God taken from the Bible. Three that are common to the stories of Jews and Christians and Muslims. You may never have heard of these before, but see how you respond to them when you hear of them. All these come from the book of Deuteronomy, chapters 20 to 22. If you like them, you can find dozens more like them in that book. First, if a man is found lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die. All the times I hear literalist Christians say that every word of the Bible is the word of God, I've never heard one quote that. And I don't think they believe it. Especially if a third of them are doing it. Second, if upon marriage it is discovered that a woman isn't a virgin, the men of the city shall stone her to death. Never heard that preached by Jerry Falwell, who is very sure that every word of the Bible is literally true. Why is that? Third, if a son is stubborn and won't obey his parents, then his parents will bring him to the elders at the city gate, and the men of the city will stone him to death. The men of the city have a lot to do in that. It would involve some significant arm strength, I think. Now, I know how you felt when you heard these things. You knew that's nonsense. You know it's a horrible concept of God. Someone has turned God into a hand puppet and created a God that is disturbed and distorted and sick and dangerous and awful, and you knew it. That's why even Christian fundamentalists won't quote those lines. They don't believe a word of it. They know it's not true. Those are bad gods someone created. Every parent of rebellious teenage sons or daughters, I don't mean to discriminate against teenage girls, can identify with the frustration of whoever wrote that third thing. But you also know that anybody who actually did that, anyone who would actually murder their children because hormones have entered their system, is a dangerous, sick, murderous person following a dangerous, sick, murderous concept of God. And you know it instinctively. You can sense that those awful sayings must have originated at a particular time and place, 2,500 years or so ago, when whoever made them up was having trouble with social control and family control, and so they put those awful noises in the words of their God, like going out in the middle of the night and spinning the bull roarer to make those sounds, and then told the people what they had to do to make the God happy. Last week I talked about escaping from the fool's paradise pictured in the Garden of Eden and how that was celebrated for so long as the freedom and the glory of human nature that let us grow beyond a childlike paradise by learning the difference between good and evil. This is the same kind of story. Only by doubting the authorities, I don't care whether it's in food production, automobile manufacturing, pharmaceuticals, or the creation of concepts of God, only by doubting the authorities and trying to find out for ourselves what is good and what is evil, can we ever escape from the fool's paradise of believing that all advertising companies, politicians, and preachers always have only our own best interests at heart. Now, so far, this sounds like a story with a simple plot. Just challenge authorities, defeat them, and exult in triumph, waving banners. But that's not all there is to it. Every time, think about this and see in your own mind and heart if this isn't true for you. Every time we find that another manufacturer's claim has been proven false, another group of politicians is caught lying to us, Every time another religious claim is shown to have been false and self-serving, we lose some of our naivete and some of our trust. That's a limp. That's part of the price of leaving paradise, wrestling with gods and with authorities and debunking them usually leaves us with a limp. It's never a cheap victory. Remember the time when you stopped believing that there was this one fellow called Santa Claus who came down every chimney in the world on Christmas Eve to bring you presents, even though you didn't have a chimney? Remember what you lost? I know people who say that was the end of their childhood naivete. And what happens when you reconsider the concept of God? What happens when you look at whose hands God has been in, and suddenly to you too, God looks more like a puppet than a puppeteer? And you investigate and you realize God was never making those noises. We made the noises. People made the noises. And they were making noises that may have empowered them, but didn't empower you. They enslaved you. Maybe the people even believed them who made the noises. But what happens when you realize they weren't true? I remember in graduate school when we were studying gods and how gods are created and where gods get their power and how seductive they are, and we talked about these things. And we realized at the end of this that this is a dilemma. This isn't a simple problem. This is a dilemma, and you're going to wind up limping no matter which way you go. Think about it. If you never look for the invisible first step and simply accept what you've been told authoritatively, eventually it's going to hurt you, because the truth's going to get out of date and untrue, and you have no way to escape it, and it'll hurt you. On the other hand, if you take the liberal route and rise up with your great sword and pull back the curtain in front of the Wizard of Oz and expose the puppeteer inside the hand puppet of God and expose all of the authorities, here's what you lose. You lose the ability ever again to persuade yourself that there's such a thing as eternal, unchanging truth. You don't think that's a limp? It's a limp. Do you also lose faith even in the idea of truth or goodness or justice or beauty? Many have. That's worse than a limp. Don't do that. That one's wrong. You can always return to the fool's paradise where you try to stay ignorant and don't learn the difference, or you can pretend to. But the God in the Eden story, we know, was also created by priests and tribal chiefs who were served by that kind of compliant ignorance. Why would you want to exalt those people? They've been dead 2,500 years. Why would you want to exalt their concept of God? You might as well wrestle with God yourself and cross over. But crossing over isn't cheap. That's one way God is like Santa Claus. You lost the child's magical Santa when your eyes were opened. And you lose the child's magical God in the same way. By having your eyes opened, leaving the Garden of Eden, and realizing that we make the noises. To wrestle with gods is often to wind up disillusioned. I've heard ministers tell me this. I've heard ministers tell me that's why they soft-pedal this business of helping their people wrestle with gods, because it just disillusions them. And that sounds bad, being disillusioned. But think about this. Is being disillusioned really worse than being illusioned? Is that really a bad thing? Are illusions really what we need? I think to wrestle with the concept of God and when, you need to be armed with some of the things that I've been trying to talk about in the last two sermons in this series. I think you need to know that in the beginning we really were all made of stardust, that we are deeply at home in the universe, intimately tied to everything, that the dynamic power of the universe is also in us. That was the point of the reading I took from the old Hinduism writing of Atman and Brahman, that Brahman is the creating power of the universe, and it's in everything, and it's in us, all the way down. I think you need to know that all people really are our brothers and sisters everywhere, here, in Iraq, in Nicaragua, everywhere. And we need to remember that concepts of God that take away anyone's power or dignity are always blasphemous lies and an insult to the very idea of life and truth and God and love and everything that is holy or whole. Wrestling with the God grants us two things. It grants us honor, and it grants us a task. Because since we make the noises, it now becomes up to us to see to it that the noises we make are sacred noises, noises of truth that empower, not that enslave, of understanding rather than prejudice, of love rather than hate, truth that sets us and others free, not that ever puts anyone in heavier chains. Part of growing up religiously is understanding who makes the noises. This isn't easy. When one of the books that talks about how gods are made, and these are things studied in good divinity schools, when one of these books was offered in a class in a seminary in Chicago when I was there, a priest who'd been serving his parish for 25 years and had come back to take some advanced learning was exposed to this book. He told the Jesuit who was teaching the course that this book should be banned by the Pope, that no one should ever be allowed to read these things. And the Jesuit, if you've ever studied with the Jesuits, you probably love them like I love them. They have such wonderful education and such free minds. And the Jesuit said, "Father, if you really believe that, you don't belong in the parish, you belong in a monastery." Growing up religiously is understanding who makes the noises and that all gods are hand puppets. And it's the search for the hands that make the puppets move and the agendas and the beliefs that make the puppets speak. And it's asking whether that's worthy of the concept of God, whether it's worthy of the concept of truth or of life or of love. The other task that's given us when we wrestle to God is that we lose our excuse not to act. We lose our excuse for not getting involved. That's our human calling, to escape from the fool's paradise and search for truth and wholeness east of Eden. Now, this is what magicians aren't supposed to do in magic shows. I hope you see that what I tried to do this morning follows the same three steps. First, I start with what, to me, is the most true and useful way to understand how we make our gods. I don't know how else to think about it. That's my world. That's the invisible first step that I just made visible. Then, I've tried to convince you that it's true. And since it's true, that your life will be better if you incorporate it. Now, am I right? Is it true? Is this the best kind of truth for you? Is this how you want to think about gods, if you want to think about them at all? This is where I came out when I wrestled with the idea of God. Eventually, you'll have to wrestle too. And I recommend it. Even if the ordeal leaves you with a limp. Because there are lives at stake. And one of them is yours.